Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin here with your wake-up call on Monday, September the 10th, 2012. And a special welcome again to those of you who are listening to PRN at your usual hour of 2 p.m., but to the wake-up call for the very first time. America, land of the delusional and home of the vain, where the appearance of success is more important than actual success itself. The corporate mainstream media dutifully reports the surge in auto sales as surely a sign that the economy is recovering and the consumer has finished deleveraging and is ready to spend again. The government propaganda machine proclaims the surging auto sales are due to their wise and forward-thinking policies, like the Chevy Volt. Well, luckily for them, there are millions of gullible Americans who believe the storyline and are easily convinced that driving a $30,000 new car financed over 7 years makes them a success. The decades of Bernaysian marketing propaganda has worked its magic on the government-educated, math-challenged citizenry. There are only two things that matter to the non-thinking auto buyer, actually, of course, a renter: the monthly payment and what the next-door neighbor and his co-workers will think. See, buying a fuel-efficient car they can afford, paying it off in 3 or 4 years and driving it for 10 years while saving the monthly payment is what a practical, rational-thinking person would do. The fact that only 20% of the 9.7 million vehicles sold this year have been small cars in a land of near-record gas prices, and the fact that average sales prices of new cars sold is now $31,000, prove that Americans are still living in a delusional fantasy land of cheap gas and monthly payments for eternity. As gas prices surpass $4 a gallon across the country, somehow 4.7 million of the 9.7 million vehicles sold in 2012 have been pickups, vans, crossovers, or SUVs. Three of the top eight selling vehicles are pickups. Luxury vehicle sales are booming, with Mercedes, BMW, Porsche, Land Rover, and Audi showing double-digit percentage sales gains over 2011. We've entered a recession. Gas prices are approaching all-time highs. Job growth is pitiful. And Americans continue to buy luxury gas guzzlers on credit. Ladies and gentlemen, talk about a recipe for disaster. The average payment on a new car in 2012 is $461. For used cars, the average monthly payment is $346. Today, 77% of new car purchases are financed. About half of all used vehicles involve financing. Of those cars financed, 89% are through a loan versus 11% with a lease. A critical thinking person might wonder how a country with 4 million less employed people than we had in 2007, median household net worth down 35%, and real wages lower than they were in 2007, could be experiencing an auto boom. The answer is a government, corporate, banker, media effort to funnel taxpayer funds to deadbeats across the land in a fruitless attempt to create a facade of recovery. The governing elite are convinced that more debt peddled to the masses is the path to recovery for an economy that imploded due to excessive debt peddled to the masses in the first place. Essentially, it comes down to who benefits from the peddling of debt. It isn't the masses, as they become enslaved in the chains of debt and monthly payments in perpetuity. Debt peddling benefits Wall Street bankers, politicians, and mega corporations selling crap to the masses. The storyline being sold to the vegetative dupes watching Honey Boo Boo that occupy space in this delusional paradise we call America by the corporate media is that consumers have deleveraged and are ready to resume their normal pattern of spending money they don't have on stuff they don't need. Of course, the facts always seem to get in the way of a good yarn. Consumers have never deleveraged. Consumer credit outstanding is at an all-time high of $2.58 trillion. The decline from $2.55 trillion in 2008 to $2.4 trillion in 2010 was not deleveraging. It was the Wall Street too-big-to-fail banks taking a big dump on the American taxpayers. They passed their bad debts to you through TARP, the Federal Reserve buying their toxic assets, so-called, and zero interest rate policy. Revolving credit, otherwise known as credit card debt, peaked at just above $1 trillion in 2008 and declined to $850 billion during 2010. The media storyline is that you buckled down and paid off your credit cards, therefore depressing consumer spending and creating a recession. Sounds convincing, except for the fact that it's a load of crock. The Federal Reserve's own data proves it to be false. Your friendly Wall Street banks have written off $213 billion of credit card debt since 2008 and passed the bill onto the few remaining taxpayers in the country. For the math challenged, this means that consumers have actually increased their credit card debt by $68 billion since 2008. The bad news for your Chinese crap-peddling mega-retailers is that the significantly poorer average middle-class American household is using their credit cards to pay their property bills, IRS bills, and utility bills in order to survive. The category of debt that barely budged in the 2009 collapse was non-revolving credit. It stayed in the $1.5 trillion range in 2009 and has since surged to over $1.7 trillion in 2012. What could possibly have made this debt skyrocket by $200 billion when the GDP has only grown by 12% over the same time frame? You guessed it. Your corporate fascist friends in Washington, D.C. and on Wall Street. Non-revolving debt consists of auto loan debt of $663 billion and student loan debt of approximately $1 trillion. Student loan debt has shot up by $300 billion since 2008, This student loan debt is being distributed like candy by a pedophile from the federal government in an effort to artificially hold down the unemployment rate. Approximately $500 billion of the student loan debt is held directly by the federal government, up from $100 billion in 2008. The feds guarantee the majority of the remaining student loan debt. Can you think of a more apt profile of a subprime borrower than a 40-year-old former construction worker getting a liberal arts degree from the University of Phoenix, sitting at his computer in his underwear, scratching his crotch and paying with a $10,000 federal student loan from you? This fraudulent attempt to obscure the true employment situation is going to end in tears for the borrowers and the American taxpayer. It's tough to make a loan payment without a job. The student loan bailout is just over the horizon, and it's going to cost you at least $300 billion. Delinquencies are already off the charts. When has offering low-interest debt in ample portions to people without jobs, income, or assets ever backfired before? The bankers and politicians that control your country seem to be a one-trick pony. They will never admit that debt is the problem and reducing it the solution. The real solution would make them poorer. So their solution is to pour gasoline on the fire with more debt at lower interest rates to more people. The addict will keep injecting more poison into their system until sudden death. The bankers and politicians know America is a car-centric society and appeal to its vanity and poor math skills to keep the game going. During the first quarter of this year, total U.S. car loans totaled $52.5 billion. That's 49% higher than the same period in 2009. Also during the first quarter, the average amount financed on new vehicles rose by $589 to $25,995, and for used cars by $411 to $17,050. Furthermore, buyers are stretching out payments for longer terms. The average length of new and used vehicle loans jumped a full month during the first 3 months of this year to 64 and 59 months, respectively. The surge in auto sales is being completely driven by doling out more loans for a longer time frame to deadbeat borrowers. Subprime auto loans now make up 45% of all car loans and the vast majority of all used car loans. They have even created a category called deep subprime. Borrowers classified as deep subprime, i.e. those with Vantage scores below 600, account for 10.7% of auto loans. You can also classify them as loans that will never be repaid. Two-thirds of all car sales are for used cars, so the fact that 37% of all new cars are being sold to subprime borrowers is exacerbated by the ridiculous lending practices for used cars. The fine folks at Zero Hedge have provided the outrageous data and a chart that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt what awaits the American taxpayer: another bailout. Zero Hedge has already revealed the GM fake recovery by detailing their channel stuffing over the last 2 years. Now they've dug up more dirt on why sales of cars are surging. What could possibly go wrong providing loans for more than the value of the asset to people with a history of not paying their debts? It's amazing how many cars you can sell when you aren't worried about getting paid. This is the beauty of a fiat currency, a printing press, and a taxpayer available to pick up the tab after the drunken party gets out of hand. Easy enough to see the details of the superhighway to disaster. The percentage of used car loans to prime borrowers is now at an all-time low, while the percentage of loans to subprime borrowers is near all-time highs reached just prior to the 2008 crash. When lenders cared about being paid back in the early 2000s, they rarely made loans longer than 5 years. Today, more than 77% of all subprime used car loans are longer than 5 years, and average FICO scores are now well below 600. Just to clarify, if a FICO score is below 600, you are a deadbeat. The master plan is fairly simple. The Federal Reserve lends money to the Wall Street banks for 0% interest. These banks then turn around and provide credit card debt at 13% interest, new and used car loans to prime borrowers at 5% interest, and new and used car loans to subprime borrowers at 16%. When you can borrow for free, you can take a chance that a significant number of your borrowers will default. Essentially, Ben Bernanke is screwing the prudent savers and senior citizens by paying them 0.15% on their savings in order to subsidize the bankers that destroyed the country so they could make auto loans to the same people who took out the 0% down interest, not only no-doc mortgage loans, in 2005. In addition, Wall Street knows the Bernanke put is still in place. If and when these subprime loans explode in their faces again, Bernanke and or Geithner and or Obama or Romney will come to the rescue with your tax dollars. It's heads you lose, tails you use, yet again. The top 20 auto lenders control half the market. And look at the leader of the pack. Our friends at Ally Bank are the market share leader. You remember Ally Bank? They conveniently changed their name from GMAC, General Motors Acceptance Corporation, also known as Ditec, the giant subprime mortgage lender, after losing billions and being bailed out by you. They still owe you $11 billion and are 85% owned by the U.S. Treasury. No conflict of interest there. You have the biggest auto lender on earth controlled by the Obama administration. Do you think perhaps they might have an incentive to make as many loans as humanly possible to help Obama create the illusion of an auto recovery? The only downside for the American taxpayer when you have to eat more billions in Ally GMAC losses. This insolvent excuse for a lending institution has been extremely aggressive in the subprime auto lending market and has forced the other wannabes, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Capital One, and Bank of America, to lower their lending standards. Does this scenario ring a bell? America has become a subprime auto nation, addicted to easy debt, living lives of hope, delusion, and minimum monthly payments. Stories about economic recovery, fraudulent government statistics showing lower unemployment, feel-good propaganda from the corporate mainstream media, and a return to easy money, debt-fueled spending does not constitute a real recovery. Until the bad debt is purged from the system and saving takes precedence over spending, the country will stagger and ultimately fall under the weight of its immense debt. We are lost in a blizzard of lies, this subprime-fueled engine of what they want you to think of as recovery, will propel the country into the same grim canyon of reality we entered in 2008. Enough. All right. Now is the time I give my personal information, starting with the toll-free number I'm sure all of you regular listeners to PRN are familiar with. It is 888-874-4888. And it is at your service for any comments or questions you may have. Again, 888-874-4888. If you'd rather write in your comments or questions, please feel free to write to my personal email, open at all times, including right now, at rm@gfawd.com. That's once again RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, RM@gfawd.com. I'm also very happy to try to lend some useful advice to any of you with personal problems who'd like to call me on my direct line to Singapore via a local Sarasota, Florida number on area code 941-441-1682. As I said, that's a direct line to me through Sarasota. Once again, the number 941-441-1682. Okay, well, as I explained to the newcomers on Friday, we have a meetup group, the Richard Martin meetup group, which meets every month. On the last Sunday normally of the month, and this Sunday it is April the 30th at 2 p.m., and we meet in New Brunswick, in New Jersey, at the George Street Ale House, and that is very close to the railroad station, which is itself equidistant between New York and Philadelphia. Again, that is the George Street Ale House, 371 George Street, also plentiful parking. And again, it meets on Sunday, April the 30th. And what we talk about is life in the States, with a particular emphasis on leaving the States, for those of you so inclined. And we shall have this coming session, Lewis, who will be making a presentation of his travels around Southeast Asia. And Jack is our moderator, and Jack is to be reached at 914-414-6940. And that will be Jack Chavesta, who will moderate the session in the George Street Ale House. Again, please call him and let him know you are coming. We had a record turnout last month, and we may even need larger premises, so we need to have numbers, and so it would be really great if you could give him a call as soon as you know you are able to come. Again, his number is 914-414-6940. Okay, that's Jack Chavesta. Right, well, you know, I believe that the current level of investor hope, which can easily be found on blogs and forums throughout the net, I believe it's completely misguided and utterly disconnected from fundamental conditions. You know, hope that the United States will miss a recession, hope that the central bank stimulus will revive economic growth, hope that China has a soft landing instead of a hard landing, and hope towards authorities finding a solution in the Eurozone crisis. Hope, hope, hope. There's a lot of hope out there, but from a contrarian point of view, I hold absolutely none of it. Personally, I believe a global recession is imminent, as manufacturing is now entering a sustained contraction. Period. The printing of money cannot automatically revive manufacturing or global trade. If it could have done so, the Fed would have stopped every recession since 1913. Do you see how absurd that is? Well, an honest review of the Fed's record would conclude that it's rotten. In a recent update of the Speculative Investor, Steve Saville explains why the whole concept of central banking is rotten to the core, as he said. He describes how central bankers are providers of gambling insurance to the banking system, and I quote, "The central bank offers the equivalent of gambling insurance to the banking industry. Imagine if an insurance company made the following deal with all patrons of a casino. In exchange for the patrons' promise to gamble prudently, the insurance company promises to come to the patron's aid if he finds himself short of money." Knowing that the insurance company was essentially acting as a financial backstop, at least a few gamblers would take more risk than they would otherwise. In a similar vein, knowing that the central bank will be ready, willing, and able to provide support via emergence liquidity injections if things go wrong, some private banks will take more risks. Furthermore, due to the higher profits that tend to temporarily accrue to the banks that take more risk, most banks will eventually be drawn towards riskier business practices. This is why a mechanism supposedly, according to the propaganda, put in place to prevent banking crises ends up increasing the severity and frequency of banking crises. End of quote. It's no mystery why the U.S. banking system had built up reckless lending and securitizing practices in the years leading up to the 2008 financial crisis. Reckless behavior paid well. Now, instead of enabling reckless bank lending, the Fed and other central banks has been enabling the addiction of governments to easy borrowing terms. It's now providing gambling insurance to the biggest spending addicts in history, the U.S. government. Suppressing interest rates near zero for years and years will transfer countless wealth from savers to the government budget. Well, I suggest you pay no attention to all the talk about possible solutions to this housing mess. There aren't any solutions. The question is this: what should a homeowner do now to protect against the looming disaster? The problem is that the insistence by the pundits that the worst is over has led many homeowners to believe this nonsense. On August the 20th, the website redfin.com released the results of a survey of would-be home sellers conducted during the second week of August. It found that 38% of them planned to wait more than a year before selling their home. Another 36% intended to wait anywhere from 3 to 12 months before putting the house on the market. Why are they doing this? They are optimistic that prices will be higher down the road. 80% of those surveyed believed they will get a higher price after a year or two. Only 7% thought that prices would be lower. This thinking has caused large numbers of sellers to pull their houses off the market in the last 6 months. If you are among those inclined to believe the drivel about a housing bottom, I urge you to check out the home price statistics on ravis.com. That's R-A-V-E-I-S.com. Go to your local tax assessor's office and review the sales of the past 6 months. Talk to people who have actually sold their house and find out how much of a loss they had to take. See if you can find any successful sellers under 60 years old who actually profited from the sale of their house. I believe that doing this research will cause you to reassess your optimism. Time is running out. What is the risk of keeping your home off the market until next spring? Plenty. Many major metro markets will almost certainly show signs of further weakness. Some may begin to unravel with willing buyers increasingly hard to find. I cannot think of one major market that I expect to be stronger. Once you discover that your home is underwater, many of you will probably feel trapped. There are many homeowners who are simply unwilling to contemplate taking a loss and doing a short sale. If you are simply hoping for better times ahead, I believe you will regret that inaction. Now is the time for you to act. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's stop a moment and have our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back, and for your information, in case you didn't know it, global manufacturing activity, as measured by JP Morgan, continues to slow. We now have 80% of the world's PMIs, or purchasing managers' indexes, in contraction territory, which removes the notion of any economic decoupling. Make no mistake about this, the world is in a synchronized slowdown. Commenting on the Global Manufacturing Survey, David Hensley said, and I quote, "The August PMIs point to a further modest acceleration in the rate of contraction of global industry, as the sector is buffeted by rising headwinds in a number of key economic regions and falling levels of international trade. The labor market is still holding up better than the activity indicators, but this could be threatened as signs of excess capacity become more visible." End of quote. Bob Pisani over at the Trader Talk blog summarized the ISM quite well too. He stated that this month's ISM report had a strong message with a key word, slowdown, appearing everywhere. He listed various reports from subcomponent industries out of the survey where slowdown or something similar appear. Here is his list from his blog, and I quote, "Internal indicators and feedback from sales channels are indicating a slowdown in demand for capital equipment," in the magazine Machinery. "Business continues to be very solid, but there is now a slowing of incoming orders," and that's from Fabricated Metals Products. "Incoming orders have slowed somewhat, but indications are that there will be a stronger fourth quarter." That's from Plastics and Rubber Products. "Business is slow right now. Companies seem to be holding onto their money." That's from Computer and Electronic Products. "We can sense, feel, and see headwinds with customer orders, especially Europe-related." That's from Apparel, Leather, and Allied Products. "New orders and backlog remain flat." That's from Miscellaneous Manufacturing. "Auto industry slowing a bit in the second half of the year," from Transportation Equipment. "Lackluster demand continues in all regions of the world and is supporting much lower raw materials prices in the second half of 2012. And that's from Chemical Products. "Recessions and economic contractions usually come about through inventory levels growing beyond demand, which forces companies to slash production and fire employees. In his recent September report, a well-notable bear, Albert Edwards, wrote, and I quote, "The metric which really stood out for me over recent weeks was a truly awful U.S. durable goods orders report. For although the headline July data rose by over 4%, both month over month and year over year, the core measure of new orders has slumped. Core is capital goods orders excluding the volatile aircraft component. Core orders fell 4% in July month over month and 6.6% year over year. July was not a one-off. This is now the fourth month out of the last five that core new orders have fallen sharply and is entirely consistent with the rapidly deteriorating profits backdrop. If, as I suspect, this is further evidence that the U.S. economy has already entered recession, it will not be long before the U.S. equity market reacts. Certainly, the recent pop in the market above 1425 to a post-crisis high sits badly with the facts on the ground. Irrespective of any prospect of QE3, the market will not resist this recessionary data for long. The S&P will be led hand in hand by the economic cycle over a cliff into free fall. That will be the third phase of this secular valuation bear market." End of quote. Now, please remember, that was from Albert Edwards, who has an excellent reputation as a fine technical analyst. Eurozone manufacturing, measured by market PMI, continued its theme of contraction, indicating that the Eurozone is entering a second recession within 3 years. Italy's PMI was at a 10-month low and Austria's at a 37-month low, while Spanish PMI was at a 5-month high and Netherlands at a 6-month high. Commenting on the Eurozone manufacturing survey, Rob Dobson said, and I quote, "The final reading of the August PMI confirms that the Eurozone manufacturing sector remains firmly in contraction territory. This sector is on course to act as a drag on gross domestic product in the third quarter. The national picture remains one of widespread contraction. Only Ireland saw manufacturing output rise, while larger nations like France and Germany remain in reverse gear. The situation in Italy is also becoming more of a cause for concern as it falls further down the PMI league table. Chinese manufacturing, measured by HSBC and market PMI, signaled a continued contraction in August. New orders came in at a 6-month low, which is a very worrying sign and confirms Asian export contraction. Let us not forget that many of these Asian economies are export-reliant for growth and are now facing huge headwinds in the coming quarters." Commenting on the China manufacturing survey, Hongbin Ku said, and I quote, "The final reading of the HSBC manufacturing PMI for August confirmed that China's manufacturing sector still faces intensifying downward pressure. New export orders contracted at the fastest pace since March 2009. This, combined with a record high in stocks of finished goods sub-index and a 41-month low employment index, suggests China's exporters are facing increasing difficulties amid stronger global headwinds." End of quote. Japanese manufacturing continues to slow at a more accelerated pace as well, with new orders down meaningfully in August. Production fell at the fastest rate in over 16 months, which is a sign that the post-earthquake economic rebound is now stalling. Commenting on the Japanese marketing survey data, Alex Hamilton said, and I quote, Japan's manufacturing sector download continued in August, according to PMI survey findings. The data provide further evidence to suggest that growth in the world's third-largest economy is faltering at the pace of weakened global demand conditions. Overall, new business, exports plus domestic, declined at a solid rate, while the index measuring trends in factory output fell further over the month. There was more deflationary news on the price front, with average input costs and output charges decreasing simultaneously for a third month running. Meanwhile, a muted labor market picture was signaled by the latest survey, with employment stagnating. End of quote. FedEx recently confirmed that global air freight trade volumes are already starting to contract as the company issued profit warnings. Believe me, more of those are about to come. Bloomberg writes, and I quote, FedEx Corp, operator of the world's largest cargo airline, said quarterly earnings will fall short of its forecast after a weak global economy damped revenue from express shipments. The cut in profit adds to evidence of how Europe's economic slump and slowing growth in Asia are dragging on FedEx, which is seeking money-saving efforts such as buyouts for some employees. The company is considered an economic bellwether because it moves goods ranging from financial documents to pharmaceuticals. End of quote. Please, 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 ladies and gentlemen, anyone who thinks the printing of money can create economic growth must truly be living on Mars. Well, I came across a recent article in The Atlantic magazine about the stresses of being or feeling busy. Across the world, it seems wealthier people are much more likely to complain about being busy than the poor. It's not simply that the well-to-do work more, although that's part of it. According to Daniel Hammermesh, the University of Texas economist who co-authored a 2005 study on feeling stressed out with a former graduate student, it turns out that if you hold the hours people spend at their jobs and on household chores constant, individuals who bring home bigger paychecks still feel more stressed for time. Increase a husband's income and his wife begins to feel busier. Hammermesh reached his conclusions by analyzing time use surveys from the United States, Germany, Australia, and South Korea. The results were fairly consistent across international borders, although they varied a bit in South Korea. In general, the richer a survey taker was, the more they complained about lack of time. Women, meanwhile, complained more than men. And although Hammermesh is hesitant to make cross-cultural comparisons, he says that Americans appeared to be the world champions, as he put it, of complaining. All of this seems a bit counterintuitive. After all, one of the perks of being rich is that you can afford to pay people to take care of life's little necessities in order to free up more time for life's pleasures. A nurse and a Google engineer might work the same hours, but the engineer can afford a babysitter and a maid. Nice in theory, but in practice, hiring help only makes a marginal difference, Hammermesh says. Quote, you can't pay somebody to sleep for you. You can't pay somebody to read the French classics for you, or go to the opera, or go to the movies, or go to a ball game. And that's where a bit of psychology comes into play. We all live on two things, time and money. And people who have extra income don't get much, if any, extra time to spend it. As a result, Hammermesh argues, Each of their hours seems more valuable, and they feel the clock ticking away more acutely. Much the way it's more stressful to order dinner from a menu with 100 items than 10, choosing between a night at the symphony, seats at the hot new play, or tickets to Woody Allen's latest flick is in some senses more stressful than knowing you'll have to save money by staying in for the evening. There's a lot the rich could be doing and too few hours to do it all. That isn't to say the rich are necessarily more stressed overall. While the poor are less likely to complain about a lack of time, they are much more likely to complain about lack of money. One of them is always going to be scarce for you. If you're rich, it's time that's scarce. If you're poor, it's the money that's scarce, Hamamesh says. So just remember that in the scheme of things, being busy is a nice problem to be able to afford. Well, one of the reasons I think the United States is in for devastating social unrest over the next few years is that the traditional employer-employee relationship has completely broken down. And this, by the way, is not entirely the fault of the employer. The automation that I've been talking about is largely responsible. Outsourcing to foreign countries is obviously not the fault of the domestic employer who can see his product being made by others at a tenth of the price elsewhere. According to a report just issued by the National Employment Law Project, 58% of the jobs that have been created since the end of the recession have been low-paying jobs. A low-paying job, according to the National Employment Law Project, is a job with an hourly wage between $7.69 and $13.83. But of course, you can't pay a mortgage or support a family on $13.83 an hour. Even if you got full-time hours the entire year, you would make less than $28,000 on an annual basis. The federal poverty level for a family of five is $27,010. So needless to say, most of these new jobs are not paying enough to support a middle-class lifestyle. This represents an economic failure on a fundamental level. The economy is producing very few good jobs that enable people to be able to raise families and live the American dream. The ranks of the working poor are exploding, and the number of people dependent on the government is sitting at an all-time record. If current trends continue, things are going to get a lot worse. Most of the jobs lost during the recent recession were mid-wage jobs, and most of the jobs created since then have been low-wage jobs. This represents a fundamental shift in the economy. The figures speak for themselves. 21% of the jobs lost during the last recession were low-wage jobs paying between $7.69 and $13.83 an hour. 58% of the jobs created since the end of the recession have been low-wage jobs paying between $7.69 and $13.83 an hour. 58% of the jobs created since the end of the recession have been low-paying jobs. 60% of the jobs lost during the recession were mid-wage jobs. 22% of the jobs created since the end of the recession have been mid-wage jobs. But even the high end of the mid-wage pay scale is not that great. If you make $21.13 an hour and you work full-time hours for the entire year, you'll end up making about $42,000 for the entire year. That probably can support a family of four in most areas of the country, but you really have to scrimp and save to do it. And keep in mind that 80% of all the jobs being created now pay at that level or less. What all this means is that the decline of the middle class in America is going to get a lot worse. Families are rapidly getting poorer. Real median household income has fallen another 4.8% since the last recession ended. Ladies and gentlemen, the system really is failing. Well, as the economic and financial systems of the world rapidly approach total collapse, signs of what we can expect on a mass scale are beginning to appear throughout Europe. Spain, just a few years ago, was heralded as a shining example of real estate entrepreneurship, international tourism, and a rising middle class. Today, the situation is so bad that many are unable to meet the most basic necessities for life. Spaniards have begun raiding supermarkets in order to put food on the table. Cadiz and Seville have a reported unemployment rate of 32%. In both cities, people have been joining together to loot local grocery stores of 3 tons of food, some of which was distributed to local food banks. Just a few years ago, many Spaniards would joke, saying that thanks to the new immigration wave, everyone in Spain could afford to have a sudaca as a maid. Sudaca is a derogatory term similar to wetbacks, commonly used in Spain, referring to South Americans. The irony is that these sudacas are children and grandchildren of those same Spaniards that left for South America because of the Spanish Civil War. Now, it's obvious that they are suffering many of the miseries of their sudaca brothers that went through in the past. Well, one of my many primary functions at the wake-up call is to wake you up with electroshock treatment if necessary, as to the frightful lies being told more and more with no attempt to hide them on the part of the business and governmental community. These lies are constant and pervasive, and they're being bandied about more and more brazenly. The true hallmark of a fascist society where government goes hand in hand with the corporate sector. It's not as if the lies aren't being discovered. Indeed, leading U.S. media outlets have long hired fact checkers whose sole duty is to confirm the veracity of the statements made by lead businessmen and politicians. As the Washington Post, for example, Glenn Kessler put it, who writes the paper's The Fact Checker column, awards Pinocchios to those who most egregiously stretch the truth, with the nose growing in proportion to the lie told. Nevertheless, the credibility of the U.S. media has suffered massively in recent years. In addition to the growing perception that many U.S. media outlets have a partisan bias, the media has also been hit badly by the economic crisis, and many companies have significantly scaled back their editorial operations. Tremendous pressure is also coming from increased competition with other information channels, like social networks, where rumors and erroneous information can be disseminated at wildfire pace. The American media has traditionally been known as the fourth estate because of the role it plays in monitoring the government. Increasingly, however, presidential candidates are ignoring the traditional media, further weakening this control function. Obama makes himself available to the White House press corps so rarely now that its reporters recently sent a letter of protest. In early August, they wrote that Obama has not taken a serious question from the press corps in 7 weeks. The president instead prefers to speak with local radio stations or celebrity rags like People magazine, media where critical questions about false statements aren't to be expected. Challenger Romney has also largely systematically shielded himself from reporters' questions during his campaign trips. It's unlikely that this practice will change despite all the debate over Ryan's most recent fibs. Quote, We're not going to let our campaign be dictated to by fact checkers. End of quote. That was a defiant Romney pollster Neil Newhouse saying at a panel hosted by ABC News at the Republican National Convention in Tampa last week, if you can believe it. Again, ladies and gentlemen, don't believe anything you read, see, or hear unless you have independent means to verify the information. Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen, I guess it's time, as it were, to bid you adieu. And in reference to my story about car loans at the beginning of the show, why don't we go out with Chuck Berry singing No Money Down?
As I was motivating back in town, I saw a Cadillac sign saying, no money down. So I eased on my brakes, pulled up in the drive, gunned my motor twice, then I walked inside. The dealer came to me, said, trade in that Ford, put you in a car, they'll tap the road. Just tell me what you want. And then sign that line. I'll have it brought down to you in 15 minutes time. I'ma get that car. Yeah, and I'ma head on down the road. Yeah, then I won't have to worry with that broken down ragged Ford. I want a yellow convertible, four-door DeVille, with a Continental spare, a wire chrome wheel. Don't want air condition, automatic heat. I want a full Murphy bed in my back seat. Shortwave radio, TV and a phone, 'cause I like to talk to my baby. Broken down, ragged road.